Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're examining the true cost of convenience when it comes to when, where, and how we eat.
Dark stores enable workers to eat without any kind of thought to how they're getting their food or how it might have come to be.
DoorDash, Uber, and Lyft in the past have pledged to spend $90 million to try to exempt themselves from the law.
I could be wrong, but I think there's going to be significant regulatory pushback on driverless trucks.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. Thanks for joining us for a brand new episode on this cloudy Tuesday, coming at you live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. You may have heard of Nova Scotia, Canada, but you might have a hard time placing it on the map. Located east of Maine, it is one of Canada's three maritime provinces and one of the four provinces that form Atlantic Canada. The population is around 920,000 people, which means it has just slightly less people than South Dakota. But Halifax, the capital, is bustling as a major economic center and is a popular tourist destination for those interested in all aspects of Nova Scotia sea life, including maritime history, fantastic fishing, and exploring shipwrecks. Nova Scotia is made up primarily of those from Scottish and English backgrounds, but over 5% of the existing population identifies as First Nation or Canadian Indian. While the cuisine of Canada is not something that is easily definable, Nova Scotia is a fishing culture with cuisine inspired and dominated by the sea that surrounds it. My guest today, Chef Seaton Chouse, grew up in a small fishing village in rural Nova Scotia. As a young boy, he loved seafood and would go out harvesting wild mussels and go fishing for mackerel right in front of his house. Chef has worked in multiple states, opening up concepts, and has spent a lot of his career working in large restaurant and hotel groups, including the Myriad Restaurant Group, the W Hotel, Carlton Hotel, and at Glenmere Mansion in New York. In 2005, Chef Chouse rejoined the W Hoboken to open and lead the Kitchen of Halifax, a concept inspired by his experiences growing up in Nova Scotia and his passion for northeastern farm and coastal cuisine. In 2017, Halifax earned a 3-star review from New Jersey Monthly Magazine. Chef, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I want you to tell me about growing up in a rural fishing village. I'm picturing lots of salty air whipping against a cottage, lots of lush grass, maybe fish drying or curing. How'd I do?
Any of that correct?
Way off base? What was it like growing up in rural Nova Scotia?
So as a child, it was what I knew. So it was kind of knew nothing else. But it wasn't quite like that. It wasn't necessarily fish drying on the clothesline. But I grew up right on the ocean. In storms, we'd have salt water coming up into our front yard and seaweed on our roof in big storms. But fishing wasn't a big part of my life growing up. It was more of something I did just kind of for fun. I lived very rural, lived back a mile-long dirt road, windmill for power, no running water in the house. We ground our own wheat for pancakes in the morning, hand ground. For me, it was an interesting childhood. And for me now, it kind of more reflects my current career with being a chef and kind of trying to get the products from the land as my childhood was.
What did your parents do when you were a young kid? Did they travel really far to like an urban center for work, or did they work in your village?
So they worked in around the town that I grew up in. I mean, it wasn't that rural. I mean, Nova Scotia's rural and small, but It's only where I grew up was only an hour and a half from Halifax, the big city. So
right.
It wasn't too far. Both my parents were construction workers, were contractors. So they worked kind of around the town. But we also had gardens on our property. So they grew our own produce. We raised goats. We raised pigs at one point. So we had kind of sustainable stuff on our property as well. When they worked, they would come back and harvest from there.
It felt normal for you because that was your childhood, but was that how everyone around that area grew up raising vegetables and animals and not having running water? Or was your family a little bit different in that capacity?
I definitely think my family was a little bit different with that. It's not that rural. Nova Scotia is not that rural. It was just my kind of family, how they decided to
live. It was just kind of a decision that your parents wanted to really live off the land and kind of impart that to you.
That's correct, yeah.
And so as you're growing up, you're, you know, a young adult, a teenager, are you thinking about transitioning this kind of lifestyle where you're growing things, you've got animals, and thinking that this could maybe be something that could be a career? Or did you go in a completely opposite direction, and was there another passion that you had that you went and studied?
So yeah, I didn't plan on this being a career whatsoever. Growing up, it was kind of more of a pain in the butt than anything, I think. As a child, I didn't kind of was embarrassed to have people come to the house because we didn't have running water and all my friends did. So as a child, I didn't appreciate it as much as I do now. So I wanted to be a pilot growing up. So kind of that's kind of where my kind of path led for the first few years of my late childhood.
And where did that take you?
So I moved to Virginia when I was 15 to go to be a resident in Virginia, to go to Virginia Tech, where I wanted to go to university. So I moved there to be a resident, finished high school with the plan to go to university there to become a pilot. And that's kind of where my career was going for a little while until I started cooking.
Did you get far into that pilot dream? Did you actually pursue it? Like, did you ever go up? Did you take flying lessons or anything like that?
I didn't take flying lessons, no. I was enrolled, and actually, after moving to Virginia, decided I didn't want to go to Virginia Tech, and ended up enrolling in Jacksonville University in Jacksonville, Florida, for an aeronautical engineering program, and was enrolled, got scholarships. Then kind of the summer before I was supposed to go, decided to continue cooking. I'd been cooking in high school in Virginia, just as a job, not really as a passion, but more just to make money, and realized that I loved it and would pursue that.
What kind of flipped that switch for you? Because a lot of people get their first teenage job in food. A lot of folks wash dishes, work at McDonald's. Maybe you get a good line cook job at like the local Italian restaurant, but a lot of people give it up after that. What made you think that it would be something so interesting that it really diverted you from aeronautical engineering and pursuing the flying passion that you had earlier on in your life?
Well, that's interesting. So I was actually back in Nova Scotia on a trip, just visiting with my family. I was in the airport, in Halifax Airport, getting ready to fly back to Virginia. And my stepfather and I were talking. And he basically said, "So you love cooking?" And I said, "Yeah, it's fun. I enjoy it." He said, "Well, how do you know you're going to be love being a pilot? You've never been a pilot. How do you know you're going to like that?" And I said, "You're right. I don't know." He's like, "Well, have you thought about being a chef?" And immediately I was going to respond like, no, I don't want to be a chef. And then I thought about it. I was like, I don't even have an answer for him. I don't know why I wouldn't want to be a chef. So that really got me thinking right then, was maybe I should kind of pursue this cooking. I was good at it. The chef that I worked for at that point, 2.5 years, loved working with her. And she said I was great. So I was like, you know what, maybe I will pursue it. So that's kind of what turned my mind, is I didn't really think about it until it was brought up to me by a family member. Like, hey, you should think about this. And that's kind of where I went.
So you're in Jacksonville at this point. You come back from Nova Scotia.
Hadn't moved to Jacksonville yet.
Oh, okay.
Was getting ready to move to Jacksonville. Came back to Virginia, was going to move that summer. And ended up just giving it up, not going to Jacksonville at all. Continued to cook in Virginia at the same restaurant for another year. I took a year off after high school before going to culinary school.
And so where did you go to culinary school?
Culinary Institute of Canada. So that's in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. So it's another Atlantic province.
So very back, close to home. Prince Edward Island is right north of Nova Scotia,
exactly,
right?
Yes.
Okay. So you ended up being close to home. Did you stay on campus at the culinary school? Did you commute to it? Like, how did that work?
I commuted. So the first year I actually lived about 45 minutes from the college on a farm, on a cattle farm, actually. Just rented a room from a couple guys that had a cattle farm and commuted. And then my second year I lived closer to school.
And you were coming into culinary school with actually a good amount of experience. You had done some real cooking before that. Was it a rude awakening at culinary school, or were you kind of one of the more advanced folks when you got there?
It definitely wasn't a rude awakening. I was more advanced than a lot. I mean, a lot of the students going into culinary school are fresh out of high school.
Yeah.
They hadn't cooked other than at home a little bit. But it was still a great learning experience. It was the kind of basics I knew of how to cut an onion and those type of items. But it was the classic items and the recipes and the kind of recipe development areas that I was not familiar with. So
yeah,
it was a great
mother
great
sauces, correct. Breaking down a little bit of butchery, a little bit of fish butchery,
that's
things
right.
that maybe you hadn't had your hands in before. And so was that a 1-year program? Was it?
It was a two-year associate's degree.
And so where did you end up after you graduated? You're back sort of very close to home. Was there either the allure or pressure from your parents to stay in Nova Scotia or to stay close by in Canada? Or did you just decide that you wanted to jump right back to the United States and move away again?
So, of course, my mother, who still lives in Nova Scotia, she really wanted me to move to Nova Scotia. But in between the first and second year of culinary school, I'd do an internship. And I did my internship on Nantucket Island. So for me, I had a great, incredible experience for my internship there. So I ended up, after graduating culinary school, going back to Nantucket for another year.
And Nantucket is super seasonal work. It's crazy busy during the warm months, and then it shrinks down quite a bit, right, during wintertime. And it's just locals and people that maybe ordinarily rent their houses during the summer, maybe they come back for a little bit. The place that you worked, was it in a hotel? Was it a seasonal kind of seaside fish shack type of place? What was it like?
So it was not in a hotel. It was the Chanticleer Inn. It was called an inn, but it was not an inn. It was a classical French restaurant. Had been around for over 100 years. The owner at the time took it over in the 70s, late 70s. A chef called John Charles Barraway. And it was an incredible, incredible restaurant, the number one restaurant on Nantucket Island. So it was very much classical French, as you would have seen in the 60s and 50s in France. But it was like heavy dishes, but super everything based in the classics.
So you got yelled at, and there was a lot of cream.
A lot of yelling. No talking during service at all. Zero. No music, of course, in the kitchen like sometimes you have now. It was very, very regimented. But it, for me, as a young cook, it was the perfect start to my kind of real career. Because I learned kind of the what you need to kind of the discipline you need in the kitchen.
Were you a pretty disciplined guy going into culinary school and going into that first job? Would you have considered yourself at that point to have been an organized and responsible young man, or did you need that structure?
I was definitely responsible and organized, but the structure kind of go. Having that restaurant, working at Chanticleer Inn, kind of solidified that in me. So I was organized and responsible before, but that just kind of drove it home with that.
And how do they accomplish that? Like, did you feel like you got broken down and built back up? Was it just the military precision of a French kitchen? Like, how exactly, and do you think that that translates today, or was that just a throwback that you don't think would work as well today with young people in the kitchen?
Good question. The cooks this day and age are a little different, I think, than when I was kind of growing up, and I think a lot of my chef friends kind of agree. I would, at the time, it was not kind of break you down to build you up. It was the way it was. You had to respect the chefs. You had to respect what the chef wanted. There was no option. There was no option to come in late. There was no option to call out sick. There was no option for any of that. Like, it just didn't happen. It never happened. So it was a kind of, I feel like, I'm going to sound like I'm too old right now, but it kind of, times are different now, in my opinion. I wish kind of young cooks had the same attitude that kind of we did kind of years ago.
Sure. It's like pursuit of craft versus just a paycheck sometimes.
Correct.
It
exactly.
can be sort of those mentalities, which really are on opposite sides of the spectrum. And obviously you were really digging in to pursue this as your career. Did the next stop for you, was that Louisville? Is that where you ended up?
No,
after
I ended up
that?
Going to Florida.
Okay.
So after Chanticleer ended up closing, the chef had been there for 35 years. was getting older and wanted to retire to Florida. So he sold the restaurant. I worked there the last 2 years it was open. And then I moved to South Florida, Naples area.
And so were you still doing sort of high-end French cooking in Naples?
No, actually. When I was at the Chanticleer, I said I would only cook French food after that because I was so into the French cuisine. And yeah. I ended up going to a Northern Italian restaurant after that, a resort, Marco Beach Ocean Resort. That was in Marco Island, Florida.
And so it seems like you pursue a lot of places that are sort of like bigger restaurants, bigger restaurant groups. Is that something that's just sort of happened over the course of your career? Do you like the style and the camaraderie of those bigger places? I mean, when I was looking at all the places you worked, it's a lot of hotels and big scale restaurants. Like, what about that appeals to you? Is it just coincidental, or is there something within those operations that you find appealing?
Good question. So I've kind of, after my first couple hotel places, positions, I've kind of told myself I didn't want to work in hotels anymore. There's so much kind of more you got to think about being in a hotel. You usually open 3 meal periods, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, 7 days a week, most likely. Whereas smaller restaurants sometimes are only open lunch and dinner, or just dinner, or 5 days a week, or 6 days a week. So I said I would kind of wanted to move towards the kind of just single standing restaurants, but for some reason, kind of hotels keep getting put in front of me. And that's kind of, and I think part of that is being a chef who's worked in hotels, you know what a hotel it takes. You know what it takes to work in a hotel. Whereas a chef who's not worked in hotels might be a different challenge for them. They might not be used to it. So I think people looking for a hotel chef tend to look to chefs that have experience in hotels.
Yeah, I would love for you to speak about that actually a little bit more in detail. There is a very specific skill set that a hotel chef has. And when people are hiring for their various restaurants, and you know, you go and see a job posting maybe for the Hyatt Resort in Florida, and you think to yourself, well, I'm a chef. I ran a restaurant. We had 4 or 5 people on the line, and we did 200 covers a night. A hotel is a completely different animal. And for those that have never worked in it and have never run kitchens, you've obviously run many kitchens. Can you speak to just some of the differences in a day-to-day? That what is it like to be on the line and be a chef in a hotel that someone who works in a more traditional standalone brick and mortar might not even know is a thing?
So one of the items is customers coming from the hotel kind of a little more demanding. They're staying in the hotel. They're paying a good amount of money to stay in the hotel. They're expecting you to kind of bend over backwards a little more than you might for a regular guest. I mean, it's always about the guest, of course. But when you're staying in a hotel, I kind of think the hotel guests feel a little more entitled, let's say. So you've got to be prepared for different requests and more requests than you normally would. So that's one item. The other, is which I've already kind of touched on, is being open minimum 3 meal periods in hotels. And even at the W, we're 24 hours 2 days a week. We're never closed for 24 hours straight. We're not closed. We have overnight service in the hotel. So you've got to, you don't have a period of time to come in the morning and prep up when there's no orders coming in. You've got orders coming in at all times. At the same time, you got to get ready for the other meal periods.
So at the W, and we'll get to this obviously in the second half, but you run a full overnight menu basically? Like, people can order real substantial food items at 4 in the morning?
Correct. Fridays and Saturdays, we have a cook there all night long for room service. The other days of the week, we have a limited menu. But it's 5 days a week limited menu, and then 2 days a week full-on menu.
I want to talk obviously more about hotels and staffing and just kind of like the behemoth that a hotel kitchen can be. But before we get into that, I want to ask about, of all the kind of stops along the way, you're back with the W Group, but, the one that kind of jumped out at me was the Glenmere Mansion in New York.
Yes.
I looked at the website, and it's a stunning property. Not that Nantucket isn't amazing, and you know, not that the W and the Carlton aren't great properties, but it's an extreme place to visit to work, right? It's 150 acres, and it's kind of like a stunning old world chateau. Can you speak about how you got involved with that project and what it was like?
Certainly. Yeah, Glenmere Mansion, it's in Chester, New York. So it's about 60 miles north of the city. Absolutely incredible property. It looks, if you just took a picture of it, you'd think you were somewhere on the Tuscan countryside. It is absolutely beautiful. And they actually just built a new barn connected to it for events just recently. How I got connected with them, so I was actually originally at the W Hotel 9 years ago as the chef. It was a different restaurant then. Decided to leave after about a year. And a chef friend of mine kind of was consulting at Glenmere Mansion, wasn't a permanent position, was just kind of helping them out, trying to find them staff, get them set up, and recommended I kind of check it out. So I drove up there, immediately looked at it, was like, wow, this place is gorgeous. And 60 miles, I said, oh, I'm used to commuting a little bit. 60 miles shouldn't be a problem. So I did a tasting and got the job. And it's a Relais Chateau property. So it was my first Relais Chateau property I worked at. And it was exceptional. For a chef, it was kind of a perfect world of two restaurants. We had the supper room, which was very fine dining, tasting menu only. And then we had the Frog's End Tavern, which was a more casual, it wasn't like a tavern that you would think of here in the city, but it was kind of a high-end casual kind of bar. But it was inside a 17-room exclusive inn. So you could do more, as a chef, you could do more casual food. I had some pot pies on the menu, different braised dishes, more casual. And then you had the supper room menu for you could kind of experiment and have fun.
And there was the clientele mostly either people staying at the hotel and then buyouts for weddings and things like that? Or did it draw from neighboring? Because it's a pretty fancy restaurant. Is it the type of place that people make a reservation on a Tuesday and they just go there for dinner? Or is it really just like a special occasion type place?
Some or both. It was pretty much if you were staying there, you were pretty much eating there. Mm-hmm. But there were only 17 rooms, so
okay.
you couldn't just rely on in-house guests. There were people in the community that would come in for lunch, come in for dinner. We did wine dinners every Thursday night, different wine region every Thursday. So a lot of the locals would come for that. It was kind of priced kind of more affordable, and it was fun because it changed up. So a lot of locals would come in.
Did you stay on the grounds during that job, or did you live off-site?
No, I lived the same place I live now in the city, Midtown.
Wow.
So I commuted. Reverse commute, drove there every day.
How was that on your mental psyche?
that's the reason why I'm not there right now. It was it was incredible. Days that were no traffic, it was only an hour and 15 to an hour and 30. But when I hit traffic, sometimes coming back into the city, it'd be 2.5 to 3 hours, and just adding that to a chef's normal long days is too much.
At the end of your shift, you kind of just want to hop in a cab or hop on a train and be home.
That's
right?
Yeah.
Do you still live in Midtown and commute to Hoboken?
I do.
Okay.
I do, yes.
So you're still in the same spot. So after you are at that property, at that point, you've been an executive chef for quite some time. And do you feel at that point in your career that you have your own specific individual style, or were you still kind of finding your own voice in the French, Italian, fine dining kind of landscapes that you had been working?
I feel like I was kind of finding my own voice my whole career up until Halifax. I was working in different restaurants that already had an existing concept that wasn't necessarily my concept. So whether it be a Northern Italian or classical French, or Glenmere Mansion was kind of French European influenced, and another French restaurant I worked at. So it was more kind of they already had their own voice, kind of own concept, and I was doing my versions of those type of dishes, but I don't really feel it was necessarily my food.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about finding that voice and opening up your own concept. Stick with us here on The Line on Heritage Radio. We'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst, In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. Today, my guest is Chef Seaton Chouse. He grew up in Nova Scotia, and after going to culinary school, he moved all around the United States, working for hotel groups and some fine dining restaurants in Nantucket and Florida, and of course, on the East Coast. And his current position is the executive chef and partner in Halifax, which is located in the W Hoboken. And Halifax is a real personal project for you. We were talking just before the break about finding your own voice, working for other people, and is Halifax a true representation of what you've always wanted to do, culinary speaking?
I think it is. It is. Halifax kind of is, the name is the capital of Nova Scotia. I'm not from Halifax, the capital, but I'm from just south of that. But it represents, Halifax represents a fishing province, coastal province, the kind of where I'm from. So that's kind of what Halifax is. We're sustainable northeastern farm and coastal cuisine.
And so the specifics of the menu, I want to hear about maybe one, two dishes that you feel are really great representations of the restaurant because they speak to either Canadian cuisine, your personal history, or just fishing culture around Nova Scotia. And those two dishes, sort of what are the components of them? If you can walk us through one or two of them.
Sure. So our biggest selling dish and one of my favorites is a saffron rigatoni with lobster. And lobster coral butter and some trumpet mushrooms. This dish has been on the menu since we opened. It's one of the few dishes that have stayed on the menu. And it's kind of a representation, in my opinion, of my kind of career through multiple restaurants and kind of my career in Italian restaurants, learning fresh pastas. Or in Florida, we made, I can't even remember how many fresh pastas on the menu. And pasta's kind of been a part of me since I worked there. So we make our own fresh saffron rigatoni pasta. So we put saffron in the dough and then extrude the pasta into a rigatoni shape. And then it's with lobster. So we get local lobsters from Point Pleasant, New Jersey, and just lightly steam them. And that dish is with trumpet mushrooms. Mushrooms have always been a part of my cuisine as well. I love foraging mushrooms myself. These ones are a farm-raised mushroom. So trumpet mushrooms, lobster coral butter. So that's the roe or the eggs from the lobster. We whip into butter with a little lobster stock. And that's basically the dish. I mean, it's lobster coral. So you got a rich kind of lobster richness from the coral and the butter, fresh post lobster, and then the rigatoni pasta.
Is there such a thing as Canadian cuisine? Is there a style, or is it influenced by the ethnic groups that live in the various areas of Canada?
I think it's the same as if you said, is there an American cuisine? I mean, there's a few items you might list to that, but those dishes necessarily maybe are not just American. Canadian cuisine, I feel, is fresh and local. And it's kind of hard to put a name on Canadian cuisine because Canada is such a large country.
Sure.
It's more of kind of I think you can more represent, like you said, the cultural connections to, you got French Canadian cuisine, which is a specific kind of type of cuisine. And you have a more Atlantic provinces cuisine, which is more kind of seafoods, smoked fish. And you've got more kind of the out west, the Western Canada cuisine, which is heavier on bison and beef, heavier on kind of the meats and less on the fish. And then you get back to the kind of the West Coast cuisine, which is kind of the crab and the wild salmon. So you got kind of different regions. I don't think there's one necessarily Canadian cuisine.
Did you bring the Halifax concept with you to the W, or did you get hired and then there was some sort of conceptualization over, hey, what do you want your restaurant to be? And was did it come out of kind of a brainstorming session? I'm wondering if you were like, this is my concept and I want to do it. Are you guys into that concept, or if it was the other way around?
So it's kind of a mix. That's great. For me, this was the perfect, in my opinion, the perfect setup for a chef who wants to have his own voice. I'd worked there, like I said, before 9 years ago. I worked for a management company, didn't work directly for the owners. There's basically, to step back, there's owners that own the whole property, and they have the W Hotels running the hotel, and then they had a management company running the restaurant. So I worked for that management company before, so I didn't really know the owners too well. About 4 years ago, I heard that they were looking for a chef, and the management company wasn't there anymore. So I reached out to the owners directly, through some friends, mutual friends, and set up a meeting with them. And basically, we were exactly in the same lines. I wasn't necessarily wanting to go back to the same restaurant. They weren't wanting to keep the same restaurant. So they brought me in and basically within the first few minutes said, so what kind of restaurant do you want to put in Halifax? I was like, what do you mean? They're like, oh, we're looking for a new restaurant. I'm like, really? That's perfect. That's what I want to do. Sorry, it was a different restaurant, Xylo. So what kind of restaurant do you want to put in the Xylo space? And so immediately and during that meeting, within probably an hour and a half meeting, I expressed to them kind of a desire to do something that represented me. I represented my childhood, represented kind of sustainable, seafood-focused food. I hadn't really kind of jotted down the Halifax concept really before. It was just kind of something that I'd been longing kind of to do, something that represented kind of was more meaningful to me and not necessarily with a different label on the restaurant coming from somebody else. So it was created right then with the owners.
It must have been exciting for you and also your family to have something that felt a lot more personal than other jobs that you've had before, even when you were fully in charge. Did you make any aesthetic changes to the space to reflect the new menu, or from a budgetary constraint, could you not go that far? I mean, you know, beyond, you know, you inserting yourself and changing the menu, were there other things that you did to make it your own?
We did. We changed the whole restaurant. So the restaurant is right on the waterfront in Hoboken with a view of the city. So we didn't really want to change the view, of course. It's a beautiful view. But in the interior of the restaurant, we completely changed. We lightened up everything, all new floors. We reclaimed wood tables from old barns, oak tables. The bar, we got a company out of from here in Brooklyn called Recycled Brooklyn to build the bar out of a fallen oak tree from one of the local parks. We put a whole wall in the restaurant made from bark. It's just basically cut bark off of a tree. The whole wall is kind of bark. Lots of greenery. We did these planters all through the back bar throughout the restaurant, brought in some like a lot of nice greenery. And then we have which can be the focal point of the restaurant. We have a whole wall that's called our kind of living wall. It's not actually living. It's moss that's kind of been embalmed, let's say. So it's real moss and still green, but it's not alive anymore. So we kind of brought a lot of kind of green and light colors into the restaurant, where it was a little darker before. It was a lot more dark woods and kind of dark metals. We brightened it up a lot to reflect kind of the Nova Scotia kind of feel.
Was the opening of Halifax the first time that you'd ever flipped a hotel restaurant before and hadn't come in and run a concept, or had you been part of a opening before?
I've been part of openings before, but not turning an old restaurant into a new restaurant from start to finish. When we opened Halifax, when I started with them, it was a different restaurant called Xylo. So for the first 6 months, while we were doing all the planning and the design phase of Halifax, we were still running Xylo. And then we closed for a month. And during that literally only 30 days, we closed to do the whole renovation. It was a whirlwind renovation. During that kind of time, I got to start from start to finish. Whereas another restaurant where I worked in Louisville, Kentucky, Proof on Main, was a part of the opening team, but it was already built when I came on. So I wasn't part of the kind of whole build out of that.
What's the most challenging aspects of being a hotel chef?
Oh, challenge. It's staff. I mean, I think, I don't know if that's different from being a hotel chef or just being a chef in general, but staffing is tough. Kind of have good staff. I think that's kind of what everyone says probably as well. But I mean, back to what I said about the hours. I mean, the hours you're constantly open. So you've got more than just kind of worrying about just dinner shift or lunch shift. You've got all the shifts. So I think to me, that's one of the most challenging things is you're open every day of the week and at all times.
What's your hierarchy? What's your structure like? Do you have someone who functions as a CDC who runs specific services? Do you have set sous chefs that are tied to a service? I'm trying to, in my head, count up how much staff you would need. How many do you have in the kitchen altogether? It seems like you would need at least 25 or 30 people to run that many services.
So we have 45 total people in the kitchen. Part of that is because we do all the banquets for the hotel as well.
Sure.
So I have myself, of course, the executive chef. I have a chef de cuisine, a banquet chef, and then two sous chefs as well. So as far as the chef team is quite large, larger than you would have in a normal freestanding restaurant.
Yeah.
And then kind of the cooks and commis and stewards down from there.
And so it would be my opinion that working at a hotel has some perks, and those perks might be, all right, when things break, there's, you know, they have their guy, their team that comes in and fixes things. There's, you know, there's a night porter team that comes in and can clean the place top to bottom. What are some of the tools that you have at your disposal that someone who's never worked in a hotel might be able to implement, maybe not on such a grand scale, but what are some things that you've learned from being in a hotel that are like just necessities because it's such a large team in such a large space that someone could use as a takeaway for their restaurant?
Sure. And I think this is kind of not just being in a hotel, but for every restaurant is when things start kind of failing and kind of don't put Band-Aids on them, fix them. Band-Aids just kind of build up and then you get a bigger problem. Fix the little issues. Something that I've learned over the time, and I know some restaurants might have the budget for it, is giving your staff the tools they need to be efficient. It will eventually save you money. You might spend a little extra money getting brand new Cambros to store your product in, but your stuff's going to be more visible in the walk-in. Your prep's going to be more visible. You're going to be able to label and date easier. So that therefore you'll probably have less waste. So you're going to save money in the end. You're going to give your staff kind of a clean, organized environment. And in the end, I think you'll come out on positive, where I think some other restaurants don't necessarily have that mindset. They want to save, don't want to spend that extra $20 for a Cambro. Whereas, in my opinion, it's, you save money by spending money.
How would you consider your style of leadership? How do you teach young people in the kitchen? Staffing is always an issue that everyone on this show talks about, and building a cohesive staff, getting them to do the work, and then getting them to stay is really challenging. So
it is challenging.
How do you take all of the experience that you've had over the years and pass that along to young staff that might not have necessarily the drive that you had, 10, 15 years ago when you started cooking?
Well, I still think that's something that I'm kind of growing myself. When I was a younger chef for my first few restaurants that I was running, I was kind of a yeller and screamer because that's the way I kind of was brought up in the classical French restaurants and Italian restaurants. It was kind of, that's the way you get things done. And I realized thankfully a few years ago that you don't necessarily need to be like that. That basically staff will respond better for you just being more understanding. Still have to be stern, but be more understanding. I find my management style is I'm as flexible as possible as long as you communicate with me. Pretty much all my staff, if you give me a week or two notice, they're going to get off. You're going to get off when you ask to be off. I'd rather you request off a Saturday night than call out Saturday night because you were too scared to request off. If I was yelling and screaming at you every day, you might not have the kind of confidence to ask me for a day off. Well, I'd rather give you that day off and plan for you not to be there rather than you just not show up. So that's kind of something that I feel at least for works for me. I mean, it might not work for everyone, but I think that works for me. Most of my staff have been with me for years. Some of my staff, one of my sous chefs was a dishwasher 9 years ago when I was at the W, and he's still with me as a sous chef now.
That's awesome that you've been able to help him grow and keep roles for him within your organization so that they stay. That's part of the challenge is giving people the opportunities to step up. Sometimes it's just not available at the right time and then they leave. I'm wondering about, since you're now in a place that really represents you and you're able to be fully in control and put whatever you want on the menu, do you think about the future 5-10 years from now? Are there other projects that are brewing in the back of your mind? Do you feel really content and satisfied with where you are right now? Or are you getting a little bit of an itch in any way?
So I'm content, but I'm definitely not satisfied. I don't think a chef can ever be really satisfied. I keep quite busy. I just got back last night from another property I have in Northern California called Timber Cove. The restaurant's Coast Kitchen, and that's in Jenner, California. So I was brought into this project about a year and a half ago. It's the same main owner as the W in Halifax restaurant. And he has this property, and he asked me to be a partner with him a year and a half ago. So I'm a partner in the restaurant there. So that keeps me quite busy. I'm there every month for a minimum a week. So that's one project that I'm working on and been working on for a while. Definitely have other projects that I'm looking at doing and kind of want to do more of a high-end kind of tasting menu, small restaurant, kind of speakeasy style. Still working on that though, so not too much information on that.
That's intense. You have bi-coastal restaurants that are occupying a lot of your time. The California project, how do you manage that from afar?
Staffing is the same. This is the answer to that. Having good staff you can trust and work with is key. And that property is unique in that it's quite remote. It's on the Sonoma coast. And you think of a California as big cities. Well, this is a 2.5-hour drive from San Francisco, quite remote. The closest town is 30 minutes away, and that's a small town. Closest big town's an hour and a half away. So to there, you have to have staff you can count on. And how I've kind of managed that is kind of brought a team from here, from the East Coast. So my chef there, he's been there right now a year. He was a sous chef for me at Halifax. And then he basically moved out there with his whole family to take over. One of the sous chefs and the pastry chef is from here as well. She was a pastry chef at Halifax and had the opportunity to move out there. A couple of the dining room managers came from Halifax as well. So I've got a strong team that kind of I've worked with for years now that are kind of helping there. So that's how it makes it possible for me. If it wasn't for the staff, it wouldn't be possible. I couldn't run both restaurants 3,000 miles away.
Yeah, it sounds kind of impossible anyways. Obviously, you're managing doing it, but I imagine that on days that you get an email and you're in New York or vice versa, there's a certain amount of added stress to the fact that you can't just hop in a Lyft and shoot over to your other property and check in what's going on. There's a huge amount of trust that goes on beyond a sort of a normal two-property executive chef type of experience. You really have to let those people do their job because you can't really babysit them every single day when you're across the country. Geographically closer, but still far in people's minds is the fact that even you live in New York, but your restaurant's in Hoboken. I'm curious about how, if this is true or not, is there a perception of New Yorkers traveling to Hoboken to eat dinner? Is that a problem that you face with the restaurant that you're trying to get people that live in the city to come visit the restaurant, or is that not really an issue whatsoever?
I wouldn't say it's an issue. Do we get a lot of people coming to Halifax from New York City just to come to the restaurant? No, not a whole lot. Once people come, then they do. I have a couple that I met at an event in the city a few months ago that live in Long Island, and they came in for 2 days just to come to the restaurant. They stayed at the hotel literally just to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the restaurant.
That's
which
awesome.
Was amazing. But Hoboken is a lot of Hoboken, the people that live there are people that work in the city.
Right.
They choose to live there, kind of a little less stress, a little a little more room. So a lot of our clientele are locals. We're not necessarily, we're in a hotel, but we're not a hotel restaurant. So we get maybe 20% of our businesses from the hotel, which is great, but it's mostly locals. And the locals are kind of Hoboken, kind of Jersey City, Bergen County kind of area. But we do get people from the city. It's amazing to me how many people have never been to Hoboken, myself included. When I first went there 9 years ago, I was like, wow, this is like a community. This is not like you're in the city, and then you're literally looking at Manhattan skyline right there. It's a beautiful kind of place. So, yes, we would like more New York City people to come, but I understand. I mean, there's so many restaurants in Manhattan. It's in Brooklyn. It's kind of a longer little commute, but it's worth it.
The view's unbeatable, though. You're looking at Manhattan, which obviously, no matter what, where you are, FIDI, South Seaport, it doesn't really matter. You're looking out from that beautiful view. Let's let everyone know what the address is of Halifax, the website, how can they find it? And obviously, you're open all the time, so they can come whenever they want. But where is it located in Hoboken?
So we're on 3rd and River Street. The address is 225 River Street. We're right on the waterfront. In the W Hotel, and if you're looking from the city, you just look for the big W on top of the hotel. So you can take the PATH train, the Hoboken PATH train, and it's a 3-block walk from the PATH train, so it's quite close. And the walk is right along the water, like you said, with a beautiful view of the city. Our website is HalifaxHoboken.com. We're open breakfast, lunch, and dinner Monday through Friday, and then breakfast, brunch, and dinner on Saturdays and Sundays. We do a great brunch Saturdays and Sundays as well.
And the California project is located where?
It's in Jenner. It's north of Jenner, California. It's right on Highway 1, right on the coast. And it's called Timber Cove Resort. We just got named, actually, as of yesterday, the number one resort in Northern California by Condé Nast Magazine.
Awesome.
So that's great for us, yeah.
Cool. And the website, in case anyone wants to get out there?
TimberCoveResort.com.
Awesome. Chef, thanks so much for being here and sharing a little bit about your background and, of course, telling us all about Halifax and all the great projects and all the places that you've worked over the years. It's been a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Eli.
Everyone, thanks for listening, and you can join us every Tuesday for new episodes of The Line with chefs and restaurateurs telling about their career and their life story. Join us next week for a brand new episode, and if you want to find old episodes, you can find them at heritageradionetwork.org/The Line, or you can download them anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. The Line is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners just like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.